lovely to be up on your island again. As usual, I'm never sure whether I'm supposed to welcome you or you welcome me.
We're so welcome. Welcome.
And you're welcome too. Phyllis and I were out visiting her garden earlier, and it reminded me of a cute story of a little boy who was out proudly showing the garden that he'd been working on to the minister. And he says, "Oh," the little boy says, "I've done such a good job with this." So the minister thought he'd teach the little boy a little lesson in humility. He says, "Well, remember, it's you and God, you know." And the little boy looked consternated for a minute, and then he thought, and he says, "Well, you should have thought when just God had it." Took a trip in April down to California, and it was a pilgrimage as much as anything. So I thought I'd just read to you a few notes that I made along the way. We were flying home. We, Larry, Kate, and I are flying home now from our trip to California. This trip has been, among other things, a pilgrimage. From this standpoint, the journey has been wonderful success. Marge Ranney escorted our activities and acted as our host to Los Angeles, City of the Angels, of which she must certainly be counted as one. Her escort was doubly meaningful, as she had hosted and escorted Mother 30 years before to India and elsewhere. From the start, visiting Yoganandaji's Lake Shrine, we experienced the beauty and peace of that oasis of spiritual vibrations amidst the desert of worldly concerns and activity. With a beautifully constructed temple newly built above the lake, every plant and building are kept immaculate. Truly, the outer shell of this hive of God stands as a testament to orderliness, and the feeling of peace remains as a testament to the lasting presence of a great saint. The service we attended on Sunday was appropriately focused on finding peace. As the speaker, Swami Mityananda, commented, "When out in the ocean, in an 18-foot boat, with no land in sight, there is no need for any to speak of God. The open grandeur of the sky and the vastness of the ocean, the vulnerability of man, makes for a wordless worship." Breathtaking imagery. Next visit was to Mount Washington, headquarters of Self-Realization Fellowship. The spiritual vibrations of Master and over 50 years of sincere seekers are terrific. Meditating in the main building, Lari Mahasya emerged to my inner vision, only to dissolve into Sri Yukteswar. Master then came to view. Feeling the blessings of those great masters, I felt closer to the one infinite master through and through. Next on our pilgrimage was the mission of San Juan Capistrano, founded November 1, 1776. This mission must have been a true oasis to early Spanish travelers. Trees and plants imported from Asia and Africa, rustic tools for tanning hides and pressing olives into oil. The setting is charming and peaceful. The highlight is a tiny chapel with a statue of Saint Peregrine, dedicated especially to those who suffer from cancer. This site has been the place of many healings. Certainly those facing death straight on are surely motivated to seek the divine presence. That little chapel is vibrant with the presence of God to such a degree that I felt transported to realms spiritual. The blue of the Christ magnified before me. O Heavenly Father, east and west joined, north and south come together in an apex of single-pointed spiritual consciousness that is at once localized and circumference never. Certainly we have proof positive that Catholic, Protestant, Jew, Buddhist, and Hindu all derive their inspiration from a single source. Surely the world at large will one day come to this unifying vision and create peace among all people of this earth. Motoring down the Southern California coastline, we arrived at Encinitas, home of the hermitage that Master had visions of since as a young man. A gift of Rajashri Janakananda upon Master's return from India, the Encinitas Hermitage sits atop a bluff that overlooks the Pacific Ocean. Pacific, which means peace, is certainly an apt description for this beautiful setting. Terraced ponds and waterfalls display flowers and trees that are only outdone by an oceanic vista. Again, what peace, what joy to tread the same ground walked upon by that great master from India. A bhajan was given that evening that featured East Indian instruments and chanting. What wonderful service by devotees of God. Next day, on to Prem, grandson of Papa Ramda. What joy, what sheer bliss to be in his presence. His joyous wife, Sheila, served us a delicious lassi, a yogurt drink flavored with rose water. Not an hour passed that we were not served another course of food. The feeling in their home resonated with the all-powerful vibration of Ram Nam. Drunk on the name of God, the mind is suspended. Only the feeling of God remains. That night, a bhajan of Prem, Sheila, and their son Deepak, leading over 100 voices and music devoted to God. Special mention should be made of Shivak Ram, Louise Annette, and Sharon Janice. Shivak Ram has published Swami Ramdas's books here in America, and started a newsletter to spread interest in Papa's and Anandashram's work. Louise is a very devoted soul who has helped organize the newsletter. Sharon has pursued the spiritual path and has written an autobiographical book due to be published this fall. All made harmonious spiritual company during our stay at Prem's. What joy it is to live in service to the one all-powerful spirit that resides within us all. There can be no doubt as to the value of being in the presence of true devotees of God. Prem and Sheila radiate the presence of God, service towards all, and humility. When we stand in the presence of such ones, God is magnified within us. Such was my experience. God can be said to be ever new joy. Certainly in traveling to these holy places, and meeting devotees of the all-powerful Ram, bliss and joy was experienced and continues to ring in my soul. Marge then escorted us to a Zen monastery on Mount Baldy. Marge sees it as her path to serve God by serving those who come across her path by housing, feeding, and making travel arrangements for them. She did this with us in such perfection that we felt as though the guests were treated as gods. She had also done this for Mother many years before. Whenever I think of her now, I feel her firmly ensconced in my heart. High atop Mount Baldy, above the bustle of busy Los Angeles, is perched a monastery made up of scattered cabins that houses 12 full-time inmates. The pine trees whisper in the breeze, carrying a peaceful vibration and a wonderful fragrance of dry air and pines. We sat around a fire pit and felt the vibrations of the many meditative minds that have been there. In Zen practice, the goal is the empty mind. Through that empty mind, room is made for the infinite mind. The renunciant we met there had clear eyes and a calm manner. Coming from Germany, he showed that truth seekers are worldwide. His calm intelligence spoke volumes for their practice. From the high mountain, we drove to the ocean to bathe our feet and to be purified in the ocean. Singing God's name to the ocean, it seemed the ocean sang its own song of praise back. Blissful harmony as I breathed the universe and it breathed me. Final moments with Marge, her housemate Jim, who plays a beautiful Indian wood flute and stands as protector of Marge. Also, my Dawn, my daughter, who found new friends in Marge and Jim. My heart sings in gratitude to my infinite beloved for the blessings he continues to pour out. So much thanksgiving for the joy of visiting this various sacred centers and personalities for the ideal companionship of fellow pilgrims Larry and Kate. O infinite divine, make your presence known to one and all. Make this universe dance in harmony with your song through and through. As I finish writing this, I hear in my soul Prem singing, Hari Om, Hari Om, Hari Om. That's my life hearing about pilgrimage. It's wonderful, really, to go to places that are just permeated with meditative minds and that highest spiritual vibration. I'd like to read this evening from an article by Paramahansa Yogananda. The Wisdom Way to Overcome Karma. The quote from the Bhagavad Gita. Even if thou art the chief sinner among all sinners, yet by the sole raft of wisdom, thou shalt safely cross the sea of sins. As enkindled flame converts firewood into ashes, so does the fire of wisdom consume to ashes all karma. Verily, nothing else in this world is as sanctifying as wisdom. In due course of time, the devotee who is successful in yoga will spontaneously realize this within himself. Much has been written about the law of karma, but I am afraid that the karmic theory, as sagely explained by the masters of India, has been so distorted by non-understanding minds that Western peoples have garnered a wrong idea about this great cosmic principle of cause and effect. You have relegated the word karma to a limited meaning, to refer only to the past. But this is erroneous. Karma, in general, means action, not merely the effects of past actions. It can refer to action performed in the past or now, or that might be done in the future. When you say water, you may be referring to water in general, or you may be specifically mean fresh water or salt water or some kind of other water. So the real meaning of karma is any action you perform, and the sum total of all your actions, both good and bad, present and past. Actions that you are performing now are called present karma. Actions that have been performed in the past, that have already been performed, are called past karma. And when you refer to the effects of past actions, you would say, this is the result of my past karma. Even then, you are not telling what kind of karma, beneficial or pain-producing. Then comes the question, what are the springs of action? What influences you to act and behave in a certain way? Now we have launched into the heart of the matter. You act in a certain way today, and you say, I have been acting this way all my life. We get deeper into deeper water when I ask you to consider the influences on those actions. There are two ways you work, prompted by your own free choice and by influences. So many subtle influences are interwoven with your decisions that it is very difficult for you to judge which actions are performed according to your own free choice and which are performed under karmic compulsion of the past or any other influences. It is rare to see a truly free man. Most people think they are free, while their minds are utterly fettered by psychological chains. These are harder to get rid of than ordinary chains, for in their subtlety, they are difficult even to recognize, not to speak of how to destroy them. It requires a great deal of knowledge to cut those psychological restraints. There may be a million years of actions of past lives pursuing you. That is why an ordinary individual finds himself so helpless to destroy the binding effects of his karma. He feels hopelessly bound by those invisible chains, influences resulting from all the actions he chose to perform in the past life, through free will or through prevailing influences. As tabloid tendencies, the actions you have performed in the past are present in the brain. Diagnosing those karmic influences is not a simple matter, but according to your salient features, inclinations, and moods, you can detect what propensities have been trailing you and how strong an influence they are on your present life and your present actions. Now, in addition to your karma from the past, what are the influences on your present life? World civilization is one of them. In whatever era a man is born, he is influenced by that civilization of that age. If one is born in the 8th century, he is influenced by that century. You are all dressing, for example, according to the present civilization. You have more materials to choose from than past centuries. You are thinking more of comfort and style than of mere warmth and necessity. Similarly, you are all eating now according to the present civilization. For instance, there is no talk about vitamins in the 6th century. So your present consciousness and actions or behavior are influenced by this present-day society. Then the next strong influence upon man is nationality. The soul identifies itself with this body and says, I am American, or I am Hindu, and so on. It is not easy to get rid of that influence, of that identification. But why should you think that you are an American, or an Indian, or a Frenchman? And why did I used to think I was a Hindu? You see, I say I used to think, because I am one with all mankind. I have trained myself that way, not to be prejudiced by nationality, race, or any other circumscription that limits the universality of the soul. I am subtly telling you how to overcome your karma too. Always remain universal in your attitude and habits of life. Then you become free. The soul has worn many garbs. Today you're an American, and in the next life possibly Chinese, and so on. That is why it is unwise to hate any nationality, for hate attracts just as love attracts. Anything you hate, you attract to yourself, that you may learn to overcome that prejudice. That is the law. For instance, those who hate a dark race will be born in that race, invariably. The greater the hatred, the stronger will be the karmic attraction to the object hated. The origin of light and dark races was influenced by climatic conditions. Climate will also change someday. It will be natural to see white races in the east and dark races in the west. That will happen, but many years from now. Then man is influenced by the community in which he now lives. He is influenced by his neighbors. If he lives in an aristocratic neighborhood, he tends to behave in an aristocratic way. If he lives among businessmen, he behaves like them. Different kinds of people have different kinds of habits that influence you. Mix with artists, and you will think that is the only way to be. I'm not condemning artists, but they need to be more practical-minded. You cannot live on beauty alone. I slept and dreamed that life was beauty. I woke to find that life was duty. You must see beauty in duty. Remain in the company of spiritual persons, and you will think spiritual thoughts. Environment is stronger than willpower. If you want to be spiritual, seek good company, and don't mix with those whose bad habits may wrongly influence you. You are also strongly influenced by your family. You think that you belong to a particular group of people, the family unit. They have put a trademark on you, and their habits encumber you. Lastly, everyone is drunk with some habits. Sometimes man is crazy about money, sometimes he is crazy for love, and then for fame, and so on. All the time battered and bludgeoned by the influence of his own habitual past actions of this life and past life. That is the hypnosis of karma. Where is your freedom? How little freedom you have left. The freedom that God has given to you as his own, to touch the Milky Way and to feel your presence in the flowers and in the stars, that freedom has gone completely because of the many influences upon you. Most people are like psychological antiques, brittle, with set ideas, with set influences. The minute you sit on them, they break. That is why our Indian astrologers say we are all puppets. I do not believe that. I believe you can destroy any karma you want to. If you close all the doors and windows in a room, darkness is there. But if you let in the light, the darkness is gone instantly. Even the darkness that has permeated a cave for thousands of years is vanquished immediately when light is brought in. Will you reason that it will take light 100 years to destroy those eons of darkness? That is foolish. So we may have karma of past lives. Under whatever civilization, nationality, community, and family we have lived, and of this life with the influences of this present civilization, nationality, community, and family. But if we realize we are gods, we will be free from karma now. Every human being is made in the image of God. If you find that image within you, how can you have any karma? God, as the master of this universe, has no karma. If you know that you are one with God, there can be no karma for you. A venomous snake is not affected by the poison within it. It is also true that while delusion or Maya is in the manifestation of God in creation, and that it affects us, it will not affect him. That is not fair, is it? That is why he has given us salvation, but it will not come unless we demand it. Being made in God's image, we can be free from karma, provided we claim our divine heritage from him. You have been led to believe exactly the opposite. To believe in karma is to give strength to it. Why should you believe you are bound? You should think, I am not a mortal being. I am a child of God. Then you cut at the root of karma, beyond the flights of fancy. Formless am I, permeating all limbs of life. No freedom do I crave, nor bondage do I fear, for I am free, ever conscious, ever new bliss. I am free. I am he, blessed spirit, I am he. But as soon as you give in to the delusion that you are a human being, you have permitted all the karma of the past to envelop you. This life is a den of thieves. Its influences rob you of your divine inheritance. When you say, I don't belong here, and you make an effort to get out, you will no longer be an unwilling captive. You must salvage your freedom. When you have made certain resolutions, have you been able to carry them out? If not, you are bound by karma. If you have been able to do the things you wanted to do, guided by your discrimination, and not because of the influences of your past or your present karma, or because of your national or social or family life, that is freedom. Judge everything from the standpoint of discrimination and wisdom. Let not your actions be governed by habits or blind obedience to social customs according to what other people think. Be free. I would like to speak this evening on attaining your own freedom. As Yogananda talks about in the article here tonight, we all come in bound, so to speak, from the past of our own actions, our own habit patterns. And because we live life mostly unconsciously, just accepting what's been given place by the society around us, by our own personal habit patterns that we have built up through time, we become slaves to those things which are habitual in our own mind. When we stand separate from ourselves, and if we could step back and take a look at what kind of influences are guiding us, then as the article says tonight, how free are we really? When you stand back and take a look at your life, how free are you? Where does your instructions come from? Where does your influences come from? If we are predominantly influenced by habit patterns and by thoughts from the past, and by the thoughts that society gives us, then that is no real freedom. We do not really understand ourselves yet, and we have not really discovered who and what we are. But when we set out on a spiritual path, we set out on a path for freedom. Now, sometimes it is that people who set out on a spiritual path only trade one set of chains for another. They take on a certain dogma or set of beliefs that guide them in their daily living. And they suffice it with that. They suffice themselves that those who they associate with within their own groups have shared minds, have shared likes and dislikes, have a shared set of values. But until we have come into contact to that highest consciousness within us, or God consciousness within us, then we have not truly tapped into what religion or what the prophets or what great gods, men and women down through the ages have really been offering to us. We are merely accepting one more theological debris that is perhaps somewhat better than what we have gotten from our past. Real religion, real spirituality, entails us discovering this highest consciousness. Now, this is no easy task, only because this conditioning that we have gotten from the world has really penetrated not only our conscious mind, but our subconscious mind. Now, the subconscious mind acts as a repository for everything that the conscious mind either thinks or does or receives from the world, and then begins to act on it. Now, this comes in very conveniently for us when, say, for instance, we want to go drive our car. If every time we wanted to drive our car, we had to relearn those skills all over again, then we would be in real trouble trying to do anything in this life. Fortunately, our unconscious mind recognizes all the signals. It's able to start the car, put it into gear, and drive down the road, hardly without a conscious thought on our own part, once we have learned those skills. So this is a legitimate role for the unconscious to play. However, too many of us have allowed the unconscious mind to begin to dictate to us all the different things that we do with our life. And we are not mindful. We don't live a conscious life. By living a conscious life, I mean being fully aware at all times of what you are doing, what you are about, and most of all, where you derive your inspiration from, your direction from. Now, when we dive deeper into meditation, we set aside all thoughts of nationality and of race. When we close our eyes, there is no color other than the darkness that's within us at the moment that we first close our eyes for meditation. So all race, all nationality is wiped out. Subconscious patterns then continue to come up into our conscious mind, and those we have to release and let go of bit by bit. Now, when these thoughts come up, they grab hold of the attention of our conscious mind, and suddenly, when we have sat down to meditate and to be quiet, we're 1,000 miles away thinking about everything except for our meditative state of mind. But by continued practice with this, gradually we become freed. We experience moments of freedom where we have true peace within our minds. They're not skittering those thoughts from one thing to another, but rather there is an internal set of quietness. When that quietness descends on our mind, we can get a glimpse into what might be called the divine mind. Through that peace, we can experience spontaneous joy. Also, there is spontaneous wisdom that erupts there. Now, the reasonable mind has been held out to such a degree as really the greatest thing in the West. Reason, it is true, has taken us a long way in terms of making discoveries in science and law and other ways that have helped us in our life. But it is a limited action of the mind, this reasonable mind, and can only take us so far. When we go into the spiritual state of consciousness, we move into the intuitive mind. And there the intuitive mind can open up to us new worlds, new ways of thinking, new truths can be revealed before us. Unlike the reasonable mind, it doesn't take time to take in an idea and then think about it and then to come up with some kind of solution. The intuitive mind grasps a understanding or a thought all in one swift action. And you are not separated from it as you are with the reasonable mind, but rather your entire being resonates with the power of that truth. And when you feel it inside of yourself, you know it, because every part of your being responds to that great truth that's being revealed within you. And so this is the difference between the reasonable mind and the intuitive mind. And it is through the intuitive mind that we can have access to the wisdom that is inherent within you and within me and within every creature. Because we are told that the Christ is the firstborn of every creature. Now, the Christ is another word for this universal spirit, this universal consciousness. It was not contained in just one individual who lived 2,000 years ago, but rather it is that universal intelligence that is the firstborn of every creature, and that includes you and me. One of the things that makes it difficult to change is our own belief system. And one of the things that we believe about change is that change is hard. Change is difficult. If you think about the fact that you are made up of spirit first, that it is the prime and most essential aspect of who you are, that when you begin to really explore the realms of spirit, you feel more like yourself than ever before. The fear is, oftentimes, in diving deep to go inside, is that we will find that we are nothing, or that we will find that we are so objectionable deep down inside that we won't want anything to do with it. But this is not the truth. The truth is that at your very core, at your very essence, you have tremendous purity. There is the whole power of the universe that has gone into creating this universe right within your own soul. And that power has the ability to bring into manifestation whatever God within you wishes. Now, that is a great secret within the spiritual path, is that it is what this higher intelligence within you wishes. You become the observer. You become the witness to what happens within you. In a human-directed life, we are in charge of our own boat. And for a healthy ego, this is a good thing. It can go out and it can create things in this world. It can make things happen. It can be a very positive force for good. But when you get into the spiritual nature of things, there again you find that the reasonable mind, the human mind, what in yoga is called the manas, which is the reasonable mind, is so limited that it will not take you where you need to go, spiritually speaking. So all of our attachments to our thoughts about how things are, about what the rules are, about who we are and how we define ourselves, we need to let all of those go. And as the saying goes, that we need to become as children in order to enter into the kingdom of heaven, In other words, we need to drop all the pretense of everything that we believe about ourselves and about the world and about the universe. Open ourselves up, even as children, step into the universe, brand new, unassuming, wide open to how things are, wide open to their own learning. It's a great difficulty within science that once something has been discovered, that to see it with new eyes, that there may be greater discoveries beyond that, becomes extremely difficult because then the new orthodoxy comes in. And so this is the way that it has to be, you see. This is the way it was with Einstein and his theories, and it was so accepted that when quantum theory first came along, there was tremendous resistance to it within the scientific community. And now it has become more of an accepted fact. But as quantum theory becomes more of an accepted fact, the next theories will have also difficulty in gaining merit. And this is the way that we are as human beings. So this idea of letting go of our pre-constructed ideas about how things are, about opening ourselves up to the great mystery of what life is, that we have hidden wisdom if we would just let go of our own thought patterns long enough to allow these wisdom thoughts to come pouring into our own mind. This is not difficult in one sense, and that is let go. Let go of your preconceptions. Let go of those nagging doubts. Just simply let them go. Step into the universe in a brand new way. Open your eyes as a child opens its eyes deep within yourself and allow that wisdom knowledge to come in. When you accept it openly, honestly, trustingly, then you will get more. But when you close it out, because you already have your mind made up, you know, the saying that don't bother me with facts, I got my mind made up. And that's the way that we are. So to let go of that and to enter into a new realm of consciousness and to begin to focus on what is the truth. Now Pilate, Pontius Pilate, asked Jesus, what is truth? But he didn't ask it from a true seeker's point of view. He asked it from an intellectual point of view. Is there truth? And many ask that question today in the world. Isn't all truth relative truth? Is there anything that's eternal about truth, or is it just a matter of perspective? But when you open yourself to spiritual consciousness, you will discover that there is truth, and it is an eternal truth. A simple example can be someone who goes into a restaurant, and one person orders one kind of food that's very spicy, and another person orders another kind of food that's very mild, and they may argue over which is the best. You know, the person who's spicy, well, you need to, you know, try this and, you know, you'll like it. And if you just learn to sweat a little more, it'll be okay. And for the one who likes mild, it's, no, I don't want to go there. I don't. And they have legitimate difference in their taste and what they want around that. So often in the way that we are raised, in the way that we are grown up, we were told that our preferences were wrong, or they didn't matter, or we were stupid for believing that the way that we did. And there are so many subtle influences on us today from our society that tells us that if we have an original idea, that must be stupid. That must be wrong. That's not the way that everybody else thinks. Why, though, would that be true? What makes you so special to be able to have an original thought? And so there are many things that kill original ideas and that wisdom mind working through your mind. So those two individuals who have gone into the restaurant can have legitimate differences about their likes and their dislikes around food. But if they went to the idea of stealing that food and not paying for it and walking out of the restaurant, we could all agree that that would be wrong. It's wrong to the restaurant owner. It's wrong to the waiters and the cooks and everybody who works there. It's wrong to the people who took time to raise that food and to produce it and bring it there. So we could all agree that it would be wrong to steal that food. But in terms of preferences for that food, that's legitimate differences between two human beings. And so there are many things in this world that are preferences. But there are also those universal truths. In the Old Testament, we have the Ten Commandments. In Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, we have the Yamas and the Niyamas. But they all speak to those eternal truths, those things that stay true no matter what. We were told by Jesus that he gave a new commandment, that we love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, and soul, and thy neighbor as thyself. And yet, in another way, that's not a new commandment at all. That has been the commandment for time immemorial. That the way to move into God union is to allow that power of attraction, that power of love, to begin to move within your own soul, to open yourself up to the truth of that love right within your own heart, and to allow that love to uplift your spirit until your own soul and your spiritual realm begin to commingle, and you feel the presence of that great presence of God right within your own being, right within your own spine, right within your own brain. And you feel the flow of that spiritual current moving up through your spine and emanating out through your whole being. And when you do that, you are in touch with realm spiritual. And that spiritual consciousness will begin to guide you, begin to direct you. You will feel yourself influenced by those spiritual impulses, and they will be derived from something greater than your mind, or the manas, the reasonable mind. They will be derived directly from your spiritual mind. And as you learn to tune into that, and always have your mind attuned to that, you will feel guided by it always. But there are temptations that come along in the world. We can have a wonderful meditation, feel completely in harmony with ourselves and the universe about us, and we go outside and we meet an old friend and they begin to talk to us, and we feel ourselves drawn away from that realm of consciousness. And we feel ourselves more and more attracted into the world, and we forget about who we are and what we are. And so this battle begins to ensue as we enter into the spiritual path, and we feel ourselves uplifted at times. And then other times it's as if we're in a dry desert and there is no spiritual consciousness whatsoever in sight. But it is not true that it has abandoned us. Rather, what is true is we have abandoned it. We have left the presence. And we have done it through our own conscious choice. And when we, with great determination and great will, decide to break that spell that separates our union from ourselves and the infinite, then we enter back into our spiritual home. But as long as our attachment for things of the world, things of the senses, things of the self, outdistances any drive and desire that we have for the infinite mind, then the infinite mind accedes to us. We have been given free will, and through that free will, we have been given a great gift, and that is we can reject the spiritual mind. We can reject God, but without any feelings of resentment from the spiritual mind, because it is complete in itself. So it doesn't hold resentment against us. But what we do is we build up actions and thoughts that that separate us from that infinite mind. When we believe that we are just the body, when we believe that we are just this little self. So that is the thing that we have to overcome. We have to begin to really go to work on ourselves, to focus our minds with all of our will, with all of our intention, and to keep it there focused all through the day. And when we feel that presence, stay with that presence. Even when you're chatting with a friend, constantly, unheard by any, deep down in your soul, always humming the tune, God, God, God. Whatever makes you feel close to that presence, whatever makes you know that that presence is real and true, and that is the true source and the true inspiration for all religions, is to practice that presence until you become so imbued with it that there is no difference between that self, the greater self, and the lower self. Rather, the lower self has become completely absorbed in the greater self and is but a witness for what the greater self does through you. And you feel yourself as an instrument for that higher mind to operate through. And it is a beautiful. And so it is the only way for us to attain complete freedom and emancipation. So to remove that idea that I am the body. I have a body, but I am not my body. I have feelings, but I am not my feelings. I have thoughts, but I am not my thoughts. I am immortal spirit. And by proclaiming that for yourself, you move into the truth of the essence. It is not just merely a mental thing, but it is something to be experienced. And when you experience it, then you realize the truth of it. And the truth shall set you free. I'd just like to stop there and just see if there are some new people and some who have been practicing, and just see if there's any questions about anything that I've said or about your practice. Well, there is, so to speak, the I that I identify myself with. As a human body and as an ego, as a way of identifying myself, this is me. This is I have this body. I am a male. I'm at this age, et cetera, et cetera. But the eternal I is this universal spirit that we are all connected to. It could be analogized that this human identity is like a great limb that has grown off of a trunk. But the trunk is the true source. If you cut the limb off from the trunk, the limb would cease to live. And so because that's where we draw our very life force from and our true identity from, then that is an eternal I. In that it doesn't get destroyed with the body, and it doesn't get destroyed if we lose our sense of ourself in a mental sense. For instance, if we were to go mentally insane and lost all consciousness of being an I, or if we were to go into a coma and lose all sense of an I that way, the eternal self is unaffected by that. And so that is the inner identity that goes beyond any of the influences that we were talking about in terms of nationality, race, name, any of those kinds of things. And it is the thing that has spawned this lower sense or this human sense of an I. It gives it its intelligence, the power to live, to breathe, to have its being. And so once we identify with that, then that's entering truly on the spiritual path. Sometimes we think we become something or somebody else when we do that. We make it something that's very distant from us somehow, unattainable. Or we get negative associations with it. They think, well, if I give up this little self, then I lose my freedom, or I lose my sense of identity. But when you look at these great personalities, such as Jesus or Buddha or Krishna or Mohammed, they're the most dynamic personalities this world's ever seen. So it's far from becoming a nothing. And it's far from losing your freedom, but it is gaining freedom. But you see, this little human ego with its attachments to the body, it doesn't want to give up its territory. It doesn't want to give up its attachments. So it secretly kind of feeds us this information that, well, you don't want to go there, you don't want to do that, because then you won't have what you have. But what do you have? You have a body that will someday be worm food, you know, and it's subject to ills and the pains and all the rest of it. It's not to say it's not a magnificent creation. It is. But that in the ultimate sense of things, it's such an extreme limitation. It's like narrowing your life down to such a minute aspect of creation. When you have this tremendous reservoir of spiritual consciousness available to you, it's like the story of the king who left the precincts of the palace to go out and explore his kingdom, and in the process fell down and hit his head and became amnesiac and forgot that he was a king, and he wandered the countryside as a pauper, and pretty soon he was the poorest of the poor. He felt very sorry for himself and very bedraggled. And then he was recognized by somebody as the king and was brought back to the palace and gradually began to rediscover who he was. And we are like that too. We have become so convinced that this is the sum total of who we are. And oftentimes we feel very lonely and very abandoned and very disconnected. And it's all because of this prime idea of having gained this idea of separation from the self, the eternal self. And our focus of attention has become this narrow little self. So it's a tremendous disservice we do ourselves. The Buddha means the awakened one. He awakened to that idea. Excuse me. He realized the truth of his being. And he said, the world is like sleepwalking. Everybody's walking around pretending they're dreaming, that they're playing these little roles. They've not understand who they truly are. And so these great masters come trying to awaken humanity. Oftentimes what happens is religions are formed around that, and they turned into their own kind of chains eventually, all filled with rules and dogma and people arguing over how many angels sit on the head of a pin. You know? They totally missed the point of attaining this freedom. And then they line up all these interveners in between you and your own true self. You have to go through a priest, or you have to go through a church, or you have to have this intervention or, you know, of some kind, instead of teaching you the direct path to find it yourself and to have that experience. So Jesus said of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, neither do you go in, nor do you allow others, but block their way. And many people would be surprised to hear today that they're modern-day Sadducees and Pharisees. They would match that description exactly. Yeah. And they don't focus on entering into their own spiritual consciousness, and they actively stand as the blockage, the very people who should be helping those who come to them. So the true and the eternal I is who you truly are. And it's not something different or alien. It's like when you start to discover it, it's like you really become who you always felt you were, but somehow felt was missing too. So you take whatever conception that makes you feel near and dear to that, that draws you close to it. For Yogananda, it was Divine Mother. So that Mother is closer than the Father. Mother is closer than the Father. And for Jesus, it was Father. Perhaps because of their background. Jesus lost his father earlier in his life, and Yogananda lost his mother, so maybe there's some transference there. For some, you know, the baby Krishna is the way that they relate. And some, it's the baby Christ. That they, that's what draws them. It's a spontaneous heartfelt thing. For everybody, there is that difference of attraction. But whatever it is, whatever makes you feel that presence inside of you, you cultivate that because you're cultivating the presence. That's what's universal. That's what's essential to all mankind. That's the eternal self. As a little boy who said that he didn't think that
orange
and purple went together, but he says, "I saw the sunset you made the other night, God, and you did a really good job." Sometimes think of the horizon as being the altar of God. Wonderful to come up and be able to talk to you all. I just feel the presence of God within me and in this room so greatly. And to hear the sound of the Om just roaring in. You know, sometimes you think of the freedom that exists naturally within us all. And that all the things that we rush around in this world, trying to find freedom, trying to find truth and reality, and all the while it exists right within us. There's a television show on called MASH, and the opening scene of it every week was the officers standing up in a helicopter pad, and they were looking toward the camera and off in that direction for the helicopter. And all the while, the helicopter was coming from behind them. at the last minute, they all turned around when they heard it and saw what they were looking for in the opposite direction was right behind them. And I thought how true that is for us, too, that we look out into this world for happiness and for our joy and for our oneness, and all the while it's coming up right behind us, right within us. A wonderful story in India about Krishna one day was being threatened by an evil spirit, and a very powerful spirit. And so the spirit came to earth to crush Krishna. And he rampaged everywhere and couldn't find him. And finally he just went to every part of the cosmos looking for him, couldn't find him anywhere. So eventually he went off in despair, not being able to find him. And suddenly Krishna appeared back among the people. He said, "Oh Krishna, terrible spirit was here to destroy you. Where were you? It looked everywhere and couldn't find you." Krishna says, "I was hiding the one place where I knew he would never look, right in his own heart." So this great terror, the ego, really tries to go for it and to kill the initial spirit in us. But God is always residing in our heart. Always. Even now. As your heart is beating. And this heart center isn't identical with the physical heart. It's right in the center of your heart. Chest area cavity. And that feeling of love is innate within you. And it may seem like a strange thing. I know when I first started coming and seeing Mother Hamilton, my own spiritual teacher, that I didn't feel like I had any love. I didn't feel like I really loved even my family, nobody at all. I knew what the word was, but I didn't feel like I had it in me. And when I would see certain people with her, they had such great light on their face and such great love emanating. Excuse me. And I thought to myself, I am missing the most important ingredient here. And so I went home not sure what to do about this. And I finally thought, well, it seems like a strange thing, but I'm going to ask God to give me love for God, because I don't know what that is. And I don't know what that experience is. And so through that prayer then, I was given that love and that devotion. And up until that time, I've been fairly intellectual in my approach. But when you think about it, when we have really gone after something in this lifetime, it's usually because we felt that great love, whether it's for a person or for a place or for an object of some kind. But we felt that draw, that attraction. And then our intelligence and everything else came into play to be able to possess that or have that or make that manifest somehow in our life. And so when you think about the thing that could draw you fastest and most efficiently toward God, would be that great love for God, that great desire, that great yearning for having that presence in your life. And when you have that, then God is said cannot resist your love. That acts as an irresistible magnet to pull God and God consciousness into your life. So very simply, unpresumptuously, enter into your temple, which is your own consciousness, your own body. Draw yourself in tight. Ask God to reveal himself and to appear before your sight. And God may come in an image. It may come as expanding light. It may come in whatever way your mind best accepts it, or perhaps it will reveal itself in a totally new way. But whatever way it comes, it will profoundly affect you and it will resonate through your entire being, and you will never again be the same. So what I'd like to ask each of you is to make that commitment to go deep within yourself and try it for yourself. Try it to like it. Okay. Should we have a closing prayer? Will you please pray after me?
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence,
in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet,
and surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection,
surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Solicited for anything, to sign it and just can keep in touch with stuff that's going on.
And this work, my own teacher, when she made me a teacher, there's three things that I promised. One is not to advertise or to charge money for what I did, or the third thing. What's that? I've forgotten in the moment. And it's a nice thing because it's when you don't advertise, then it's just somebody who brings somebody else, and it's nice that way. Oh, no organization at all. So the whole idea is to keep the mind and the attention on God alone, and to teach the methods and the ways and the means for making that happen. It's the greatest pleasure that I have in this life to be able to do that. So thank you for giving me the opportunity. Mm-hmm.